All right, let's take a look at the Gospel of Mark, again, chapter 2 this morning. The magazine Christianity Today published an article entitled, "Jesus Didn't Eat a Seder Meal, Why Christians Shouldn't Either." That was April 6, 2017. 4 days later, April 10, they published "Why Christians Can Celebrate Passover Too." All right, so it turned, I don't know if it was intentionally that way or if they just realized, wait a minute, there's another side of this. We should follow that up with the other viewpoint. Have you ever participated in one of these Passover Seder meals? I see some hands. A few of us have. If you're not familiar with the terminology, a Seder is the celebration meal that the Jews eat for their Passover holiday. It's not a holiday meal like we would observe for Thanksgiving, where anything goes as long as it comes out of the family recipe book, right? It's not just old favorites. There are very specific foods set at the table that have symbolic meaning. And the meal isn't just to sit down and scoop it in as fast as you can. The meal will be attended with certain readings, and the symbolism of each part of that meal is described and set out and explained. And so it's really a remembrance for the Jewish people of the Exodus from Egypt. All right? Well, many churches have kind of developed this as a thing for their own Christian celebrations to participate in a Seder as a way of understanding the Passover, as well as to look for foreshadowings in that meal of the person of Jesus Christ. So to look for symbolism in the Jewish feast that would point to Jesus. Well, this debate isn't a big scandal. It's nothing like that. It's not splitting churches. But it does become an interesting discussion point. On the side of Christians shouldn't eat a Seder or shouldn't participate in a Passover celebration, are these ideas. The Passover meal eaten today is not what Jesus ate with his disciples at the Last Supper. The traditions that are celebrated today in a Seder meal come from after the destruction of the temple in AD 70. So it's not really participating in the original Passover meal. It's something that was developed by Jewish teachers far after the original fact. So that makes the case that the symbolism there isn't really biblical symbolism at all. It's different symbolism defined by continuing Jewish tradition. And then finally, the conclusion is that so making connections between a modern-day Seder and Christianity is more like cultural appropriation. It's more like tacking Christian ideas onto something that should be left alone and respected as a Jewish tradition. Okay, that's one side. Don't throw anything at me, all right? Don't throw anything. On the side of go ahead and participate are those who say, and by the way, the article that was written for participating was written by a couple of my mentors in seminary, and I'm not sure whether I agree with them or not. But anyway, they say we should think of Jesus' Last Supper as a primitive Seder. All right, so even though they would acknowledge it's not the same, what Jesus did at the Last Supper was primitive Seder, what developed later into more modern forms. They say that participating in it helps us relate to the Jewishness of our faith heritage, and that participation builds bridges to our Jewish neighbors. All right? I'm not sure exactly where I stand on this. This isn't in our doctrinal statement. You can feel free to have your own opinion. I'm a little bit on the fence. I guess I would encourage participating in it sometime as an educational experience. I have myself. But maybe, at least for me, not making it a regular routine, not part of the regular annual Christian celebrations that, to me, seems like a little bit much. Now, just this advice. If you're involved in one of these and the leader is talking about in the holes in the matzah symbolizing Jesus being pierced, they're going too far. All right? The modern day matzah is pierced because it's developed in a modern mechanized bakery, and sometimes we just reach too far for the symbolism, right? So let's just be a little bit careful about how far we push some of the symbols in these things. We're going to be looking today at Mark chapter 2, beginning at verse 18. And you'll remember that I said we're working through five cycles of conflict, five cycles early in Jesus's ministry, where he said, in effect, don't get me wrong. And for that reason, maybe conflict, that word maybe is a little bit too strong. It seems to me that this is early. There will be strong conflict coming up. But right now it's, what are you doing, Jesus? It's more like clarification. So Jesus is ministering, and those who are observing or participating in his ministry, they keep asking questions, and he says, now don't get me wrong, it's not like this. Here's the truth about who I am. So these are really key elements, I think, in understanding Jesus. So today we come to the third of these in Mark chapter 2. And I think Jesus is saying here, in effect, I did not come to reform the old covenant of Judaism. Now, Jesus was a Jew, and he was participating in the customs. He was teaching, and much of his teaching was had a foundation in the Old Testament. But he had to clarify. He said, don't get me wrong. This is what I'm talking about is not a reform movement. And as we'll see, it's something entirely new. Now, the scene that we are looking at today comes right on the heels of the feasting that was taking place. Remember? Jesus had invited Levi, the tax collector of all people, to come and to eat together. And then we read that it wasn't just Levi, it was all these tax collectors, and there was all these sinners, and there's all of these religious outcasts, and they were getting together, and they were making a wild time of it. They're having quite a party. And so the first accusation was, Jesus, what are you doing? What are you partying with the sinners and the tax collectors for? And so he explained. So right on the heels of that, we get the passage that we're going to be looking at today. And the question arises as to why Jesus' disciples weren't fasting. Why they weren't fasting. So verse 18. Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Did you get that? John's disciples and the Pharisees, they're fasting. Probably Tuesdays and Thursdays. That was the tradition, twice a week. And people came and said to him, Jesus, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast? All of the religious people are fasting. Why don't your disciples fast? Good question. Good clarifying question. So as I pointed out, I want to note that this is, first of all, not just the Pharisees. You know, if this is a melodrama, we all boo and throw popcorn whenever you hear the word Pharisee. But we're not quite allowed to do that, are we? Because it's the disciples of John, good guy, and the Pharisees, whom we come to know as bad guys. Both of them. They're all fasting. Your disciples are having a big old time of it here with sinners and tax collectors. What a contrast. What a difference. I want you to notice that in his answer, Jesus does not give any criticism of fasting in general, nor does he talk about, well, you Pharisees, you're always just fasting for a show. Now, that comes up later, but let's not import it. He doesn't go off on the Pharisees right away and say, hey, you guys, you know, you put white stuff, you put ashes on your face, and you make it look just like you're going through misery and you're fasting. It's all for show. He didn't say anything about that. In fact, he seems to hold up fasting as the right thing to do in many cases. But he says, it's not a time to fast. Verse 19, Jesus said to them, can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. Interesting note here, this is the actual rule of the Pharisees. This is what the Pharisees said. The Pharisees said, in order to be one who's truly seeking the heart of God, who's repenting of their sins and coming right and longing for the Messiah, you should be fasting. That is, you should be giving up meals. And they said, Tuesday, Thursday is the time that we do that. That's 6 in the morning to 6 at night. No food during those times. And this shows your heart for God. So those 12 hours twice a week. But they said, if you're involved in a wedding, you're exempt. Yeah, and that makes perfect sense, you know. You don't want the bride trying to push that piece of cake in the bridegroom's mouth. I'm fasting. Yeah, it killjoy, right? You don't go to the wedding where there's a feast celebrating all this taking place. No, I'm fasting. So they were given exemption for a wedding. So Jesus is quoting the rule back to them, and he's applying the imagery to himself. He's saying, I'm the bridegroom. So naturally, there can't be any fasting going on when I'm here in your presence. It's birthday season at the Friesens. We've got a whole bunch of, just a slew of birthdays here, January, February. And it seems to me that birthdays aren't the same as I remember them. I remember this, and somebody out there knows this recipe. I don't have it. But I remember this 9x13 pan of something called a crazy cake. I haven't had a crazy cake in ages. The thing I remember about this thing, it was a chocolate cake with chocolate frosting and marshmallows and chocolate over that. The thing weighed about 13 pounds, right? I mean, you had a piece of cake when I was a child and you had a birthday. And not only that, you didn't just put pounds of gluten on your plate. You piled it over with dairy. Right? Real ice cream. And now we have a birthday and there's all these selections out on the table. Well, that one's gluten-free. It looks kind of like a chip made out of cauliflower, and you can eat that if you want. And there's some, well, it's not ice cream. It's some sort of shaved ice thing, and it's colored, but you won't taste anything. And you know, it just seems like things, it seems like we have ruined all of our celebrations by our dietary restrictions. And Jesus said, no fasting at weddings. There'll be no fasting at the wedding. We're going to be celebrating because the bridegroom has arrived. Now, the picture is of a wedding, and a Jewish wedding would go something like this. Everybody is waiting. Everybody is ready at all times. And then one day, when the groom is ready for this wedding to take place, he makes the journey to the bride's house, he shows up, and that kicks off a week-long celebration as he takes the bride back to his home where they will live together. A week-long celebration, and it's all about party, it's all about feasting, it's all about being excited and delighted with the occasion. And he says, you know what, I'm the groom, I'm here. Something has started now, and we dare not be fasting when such a dramatic new movement has occurred. So Jesus' presence and ministry signaled that Israel's time of longing and preparation was over. The time for fasting, the time for lamenting over the sins, the time of longing for God to finally send the Messiah. When? How long, Lord? How long is it going to be? It's over. Because the bridegroom has arrived. Let the party get started, right? It's a signal. So interesting here that even the fasting of John's disciples, remember? John baptized Jesus. This is a very short window here. Even their fasting had become dated quickly as Jesus began his ministry and said, no time for fasting now. Verse 20, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. Here's one of those sober notes in the book of Mark. It's just a little tone. It's just a little inkling. Oh, boy, there's a cloud just passed over the sun. Now we celebrate. It's no time to fast, and then just a little bit of a cloud passing over the sun, but there will be a day. There will be a day when the bridegroom is taken away, and you'll see disciples who are once again longing, grieving, and they will fast in that day. In my opinion, that statement is not to be taken as a reference to fasting in our day. In other words, in my opinion, that's not a justification of saying, therefore, throughout this age, everyone ought to be fasting. In fact, you'll find no command to fast in the New Testament. And it might be a surprise to you, there's only one official fast in the Old Testament. On the Day of Atonement, God said, you must fast. All other fasts were voluntary ones. That's not to say I wouldn't recommend it as a spiritual discipline. I would. But remember, it's voluntary. Nowhere are you commanded to fast. Well, we don't want to dwell on that. We want to keep going here. Jesus follows this answer up with two analogies. And if you'll read these with me, in my opinion, they go beyond the first question. He's got two analogies, but they take the whole thing a step further. It doesn't just stop with the fasting. It goes beyond that. His comment on fasting was a foreshadowing of a major change that he is announcing. The new covenant changes Jesus would institute are not going to be backward compatible with the old covenant. He's suggesting some new things in his teaching. He's living a new kind of life, and he's calling disciples to follow him that, and he says, now, nah, don't get me wrong, this isn't just a tweak of Judaism. This is brand new. So his first analogy, verse 21, no one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. You understand the concept there? Cloth that hasn't been shrunk is going to shrink. And so if you put that on a hole in your... I've got experience with patches. Many of you don't. My kids, did you ever wear a piece of clothing with a patch on it? Those of you who are my age and older, you'll remember we got brand new jeans to go off to school and we ripped a hole in them the first day, right? And what did your mom do when you got home? She got this piece, well, it was supposedly cloth. I think it was a thin piece of plywood. And ironed that puppy into that hole. And it was always stiff. You could barely bend your legs because of that stiff thing that they'd iron in right on top of your knee. And then it would always curl on the edges. And you looked like an absolute dope for the rest of the school year. That's patches, all right? Well, these patches were ones that were actually sewn in, and you get the idea that if it shrinks at a faster rate than the surrounding cloth, it's actually going to pull away, and it's going to tear a bigger hole. There's a second analogy. First one is patches. The second one is wineskin. I don't have a lot of experience with wineskins, so those of you who drink wine out of dead animals, you'll have to fill me in later. But it goes like this, verse 22. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. You lose everything. New wine is for fresh wineskins. So a wineskin, of course, is an animal that has been tanned into leather, turned inside out, and scraped and sewed to form a bottle, right? And this is especially good for holding a drink in an age when you don't have plastics. And so they would fill it up. Well, when it's new, it's got elasticity, right? That skin can stretch, and so you put new wine that is still being fermented, and gas is coming off of that new fresh wine, and that skin can stretch with that. It can absorb that. But if you take new wine, and an old skin can hold water, it can hold old wine, anything like that, but if you put new wine in an old skin that's brittle, doesn't have that elasticity anymore, then of course it's going to break, and you lose everything in that process. Now, two things here, right? There's the patches analogy, and there's the wineskin analogy. And both of them, this is your word for the day, incompatible. incompatible. I think both of these analogies, Jesus is trying to say, you remember the old Sesame Street songs? One of these things just doesn't belong here, one of these things. And you had to guess which of the four. He's saying, here's two sets of two things, and they just don't go together. They are incompatible. And his reference is to the question about fasting, but it goes way beyond there to talk about the new thing that God is doing through Jesus. And since it's a foreshadowing that way, where he says that in each case, a dynamic, there's a life, if you will, that cannot be managed by old forms, he's pointing to the new covenant. And so I don't very often do this, but I want to bounce out of Mark with you for just a moment. And I want to take you to the book of Hebrews. Hebrews, yeah. The book of Hebrews, most likely written to a community of Jews. And this community of Hebrews was wondering if their commitment to Jesus Christ as the Messiah was fruitful. And they were pondering whether they should return to the Jewish customs. And you could take the whole book of Hebrews as an answer to that question. And so the writer of Hebrews is constantly talking about the superiority of Jesus over the old forms. And you get down towards the end of the middle of the book, I suppose, chapter 8, and he's talking specifically about this issue. And so you could say, here's a new wineskin passage. And it's in Hebrews chapter 8. And I've got it up for the screen on the screen for you. And it's in the Message version, because I'm not going to take a lot of time to unpack and explain it. And I wanted to just hit you the way I think it was intended. So this is Hebrews chapter 8, verses 7 through 13. Listen to this translation of the text. But Jesus' priestly work far surpasses what other priests do, since he's working from a far better plan. The first plan, the old covenant, had worked out if the first plan, the old covenant, had worked out, a second wouldn't have been needed. But now we know the first was found wanting because God said, heads up. And you can just read that right into Mark chapter 2. Heads up. The days are coming when I'll set up a new plan for dealing with Israel and Judah. I'll throw out the old plan I set up with their ancestors when I led them by the hand out of Egypt, bread and wine, Passover, Seder. They didn't keep their part of the bargain, so I looked away and let it go. This new plan I'm making with Israel isn't going to be written on paper, isn't going to be chiseled in stone. This time I'm writing out the plan in them, carving it on the lining of their hearts. I'll be their God. They'll be my people. They won't go to school to learn about me or buy a book called God in 5 Easy Lessons. They'll all get to know me firsthand. The little and the big, the small and the great, they'll get to know me by being kindly forgiven with the slate of their sins forever wiped clean. By coming up with a new plan, a new covenant between God and his people, God put the old plan on the shelf, and there it stands, there it stays, gathering dust. Now, that's a modern-day expression, but I think it very accurately portrays what's going on as the writer of Hebrews quotes Jeremiah 31 in anticipation of a new covenant inaugurated by Jesus. So now you know when he's talking about new wine, he's talking about a new covenant. And when he's talking about new wineskins, he's saying the old forms from the old covenant won't contain it. I can't just revisit Judaism and pack new meanings. It's going to blow up. I've got to put new wine in new wineskins. Four basic concepts. We won't dwell on these. Four basic concepts in the New Covenant. First, a fresh, dynamic inwardness. And each one of these, think of new wine, okay? God's law written in the minds and hearts of his people. Number two, a fresh, dynamic relationship. The text said he's given himself to us. I will be their God. And he's taken us to himself. They will be my people. All of them. All of them by faith. Thirdly, a fresh, dynamic knowledge. They'll all know him. There's no need to say, know the Lord. They'll have a personal, direct knowledge of God. And finally, fresh, dynamic forgiveness. He can't even remember your sins anymore in Jesus. Total forgiveness. And then that dramatic conclusion in verse 13. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. It's done. The old covenant is over. The new covenant has been inaugurated in Jesus. Jesus says here, don't get me wrong, I didn't come to reform the old covenant. You're asking about fasting? Here's my chance. Don't get me wrong. I didn't come to reform Judaism. I didn't come to reform the old covenant of Moses or call you back to that. I came to inaugurate a better one, a brand new covenant. The austere lament over sin, the longing for deliverance has been replaced by the joy of fulfillment. And we should know that joy, Christian. Oh, this should be part of our DNA, the joy of our salvation. There is a prayer floating out of this passage. It's from an old hymn, "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, tune my heart to sing your praise." You see, they were feasting, they were celebrating, because those who got it knew that Jesus was singing about promises they could never have imagined before. And they're singing for the joy of those promises. This past Thursday, Carolyn and I were blessed to be able to go downtown and hear Andrea Bocelli sing. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. He's an old man now. He's Brian's age. Yeah, all of 3 years older than me, right? A thin man, blind of course, led up onto the stage. But the power in that voice is matchless. It's stunning. It's a force. It hits you like nothing you've ever heard before. We marveled at the gift that God has given that man. But I'm sure there were many others in that packed CHI center who appreciated it even more than Carolyn and I did. Because you could hear the ripple in the crowd. When the orchestra started, there'd be just a few notes, and there would be a gasp from the audience, from people who knew exactly what that aria was going to be, knew which of the operas it came from, knew the story, and maybe even knew a smattering of Italian. They were ready to hear. And so they just filled up with emotion, ready to burst as soon as the first notes came across. And I thought, how much more could this be enjoyed with a little music appreciation? If I knew a little Italian, if I knew the story of the operas, if I knew what was coming, how much more could I appreciate it? Jesus came singing a new song. Jesus came singing a new song, and it was a song that made the disciples want to party. And it drowned out the old song. The old song was beautiful, but it was melancholy. That was a song of a law in stone. It was a song of obligation. It was a song of failure to measure up. It was a song of performance. And Jesus came singing of a desire inside, a desire in our hearts with the power fulfilled in the Holy Spirit. He sang of complete forgiveness and the direct knowledge of God without the necessity of a mediator. And he sang in such a way that invites us to celebrate too. And I say, tune our hearts. Lord, tune our hearts to sing your praise. Those of us who have not known the old covenant, we don't know the burden. Tune our hearts with an appreciation for a new covenant in the gospel of Jesus Christ. As we transition now to the Lord's Supper, I just want to remind you, we're talking about fasting, we're talking about old covenant forms. Jesus' last Passover with the disciples was a launch event, wasn't it? It was a launch event. He was observing a Passover meal, old covenant. But you remember what he did? He held up the matzah, which for 1,500 years since the Exodus was the bread of bondage and freedom from slavery. That's what it represented. It represented this one thing to the Jews, but he held up that matzah, and what did he say? This is the bread of the deviation. He says, this is my body. Boom! Old covenant. Done. New covenant. Covenant of grace. Covenant of glory. Covenant of inclusion for you Gentiles. New glory, new covenant in Jesus Christ.